Today is Wednesday, April 11th, 2018, and I am interviewing George Omi at his home, 244 East Strawberry Drive, Mill Valley. My name is Mari Allen, and I am the interviewer for the Mill Valley Public Library Oral History Project. And George, if you can just let our listeners know what your voice sounds like, just tell us your full name, please.
All right. My name is George Omi, and I'm the author of American Yellow, a book about what life was like for a Japanese-American youngster with his family, mother, father, and sister, through the war, the internment, and all that came after that.
Thank you. So, George, first, tell me when you were born.
I was born in the back of a dry cleaning store in San Francisco. It's I guess it's the Polk District. Cleaners was owned and run by my parents.
And what were their names?
Kengo and Katsue Omi. They were both immigrants from Japan. My father, Kengo, came to America in 1916, and my mother came the same year. They didn't come on the same boat, but they came, summoned my father by his father, who was in Petaluma with my father's oldest brother, his oldest son, farming chickens, and my father came over to help with the chicken business. My mother, on the other hand, came to America that year. My father was 16 then, and my mother was 12. But my mother came to America summoned by her parents, who were already here running a hotel business in Stockton. And she or her father came to America shortly after she was born in Osaka, my mother. And then my mother's mother, my grandmother, left Osaka to help her husband, my grandfather, with a hotel business that he acquired when my mother was 5. And so she was raised in Japan by my my great grandfather, mm-hmm. and step grandmother.
So they were, both sides of your family were some of the very first Japanese immigrants.
Early on.
So yeah. When did the first, what was the year that each side arrived? Like the one, your grandparents in Stockton and your other in Petaluma.
Yeah, my father's oldest brother came to America first. In his family, and he was a young man when he came. He didn't come immediately to San Francisco. He was in Hawaii for about a year, I guess. He was working sugar plantations, and then came to America and worked as a domestic, and then in a drugstore. He was taking odd jobs.
And what year?
And that was about 1901 or mm-hmm. 1902. And then my grandfather, who was a school teacher in Hiroshima, had a hobby with hens and chickens, mm-hmm. Breeding them, and he was always interested in leaving teaching and going into farming chickens. but he had so many children, it was hard, you know, for him to just survive then, to keep a roof over their heads and feed the family. My uncle, his oldest son, decided then that he wanted to come to America. I guess at that time, Japan was, you know, opening up its ports, and they were industrializing, and a lot of the youngsters were leaving Japan to find work in America. And so he came first, and then my grandfather, his father, my father, my uncle's father, decided that, or suggested that maybe he could help him with a business, chicken farming. And Petaluma was the chicken capital of the world.
And I read that your father was the fifth son, is that correct?
My father was the fifth son, and grandfather came first, or was summoned by my uncle, and then later, when they needed more help, my grandfather was able to summon my father and then his younger brother.
Who I thought was interesting, his name is Roku, which is number six
in Japanese.
Well,
all the sons had numeric names. So Kazuo was Ichi, and Jiro was Ni, mm-hmm. Ikuzo was San.
Mm-hmm. So san, so I'm going to explain to our listeners, ni is two, san is three,
shiro is four, kengo was five, and rokuro was six.
And how many siblings in all? Were there any sisters?
And there were two sisters. Okay. My father had an older sister who was born after Kasubo, the firstborn, and mm-hmm. then a younger sister who was born after rokuro. So it was a large family, and the law then in America was that son could summon father and father could summon son, but brother could not summon brother. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. So my father coming to America could only come if his father were here. And his father was here because his
son.
Brother had summoned him.
Fascinating.
So my father came in 1916, and then my father's younger brother, Yokuro, came about a year after that, year or two after that. On my mother's side.
And how old was your father when he arrived?
My father was 16.
Okay.
When he,
so he was born in 1900.
Yeah. He was 15. Wait a minute. He was born in 1901,
okay.
So he would have been
15.
15, yeah. And then my mother was born in 1905, and so she came over when she was 12.
Mm-hmm.
She had to be, is that right? Did I get the numbers right? 16, 17,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how did your parents meet one another?
Well, it was a matched marriage. And at that time is interesting because they couldn't bring picture brides could no longer come to America, and Japanese men couldn't marry white women, you know. So and then with the 1925. Immigration law, no more Japanese could come into America. So fortunately for my father, my mother was already here. And I guess through an insurance salesman that was traveling all over mm-hmm. the San Joaquin Valley, you know, he stayed at my grandparents' hotel and then discovered that they had a daughter, and they knew that my father was, you know, looking to get married. So it wasn't that easy to do because there had to be investigations into the backgrounds on both sides, and it had to be a compatible wedding in terms of ranking. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it all worked out. They got married in 1929 in San Francisco, and I was born in December of 1930. And I have one sister who is 22 months younger than me. She came after me. And
what is her name?
Jeanette Arakawa. She's an Arakawa now. She was Jeanette Shizuko. She's in the book.
And what is your Japanese name?
Minoru.
Mm-hmm. And did your parents choose your American name, or did you choose?
Yeah, my father, he didn't want me to suffer what he suffered. When he came to America, they didn't have adult education in Petaluma, so he had to attend a grammar school. And he went to grammar school with his brother, my uncle's oldest son, who was 5 or 6 then. And I guess one of the teachers in that school, and this was a school in Sebastopol, Cinnabar School, it's still there. A teacher that said that she would help him learn Japanese. Let's see, I've lost my train of thought.
You were talking about his name and your name.
And his, yeah, mm-hmm. so he was always, he said when he was in that school, he was always so frustrated because people couldn't pronounce his name correctly. Kango came out, Kango, and Kango, and he said, no matter how many times I tried to correct them, it would always come back wrong, and you're not going to suffer that, so I'm going to name you George after George Washington, the first president of the United States. And so that's how I got my name, and my sister was Shizuko, and her Japanese name, and when she started grammar school, my father gave her the name Janet because Janet Gaynor was his favorite actress.
Oh.
and then her second grade teacher misspelled her name Jeanette, and so Janet became Jeanette. So it's interesting how.
And was she born at the Cleaners as well?
She was born too at the Cleaners. Mm-hmm.
So when you were growing up, did your parents speak to you fully in Japanese, or did they mix?
It was broken. It was mixed. And that, I was living in two worlds. The world of the outside and going to school, and then the world, of movies and the radio and the whole world outside our house, was just a totally different kind of world. And so the language we spoke, after the day was over, in the evenings it was all Japanese in the household. During the day it was Japanese and English. My mother could speak much better English than my father could because she went to, in Stockton, they did have adult education classes, and she went through high school and I think junior college, but learned typing and dictation. So, but my father spoke a lot of broken English. It was a mixture of Japanese and English, and so in my learning the language, I went to Japanese school, after American school, until the war began, between that, where I learned hiragana, katagana, and some kanji.
Which are the alphabets, the Japanese alphabets. And did you attend the Japanese school in Japantown, or where?
In Japantown, they had, at the Buddhist church on Pine Street in San Francisco, they had upstairs classrooms, and they had for each grade. When I was in first grade, they had book one, and second grade, book two. And I think I got up to about book five or six. Or no, book five, I guess, when the war began. But
well, I think in your book, you capture how your father's English sounded to you. Because yeah. In the dialogue you mm-hmm. use here, you capture somewhat broken English or his attempts at speaking English. And one thing that I think you mentioned in your book is that he spoke Japanese with English mixed in, and your mother tended to do the opposite, is what I gathered.
And so when I go to Japan, you know, often the language is a problem. And after a while, words that I'd forgotten, you know, come to the surface. The vocabulary is, I guess, something which, unless you speak a lot, you know, you lose it. And so the Japanese that I know is pretty much what I learned as a child. And in my writing my book, I tried to write the dialogue in a way that I could, I wasn't exactly sure, but tried to capture his way of how he spoke. And my mother, she didn't speak very much. She was very quiet, but she was a very strong woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she could speak incomplete sentences and read and write English, you know.
What's interesting is that your father had to interact with Americans all the time with his dry cleaning business.
Mm-hmm.
So what are your recollections of that interaction?
Well, he when he spoke English, he was able to express himself in a way to be understood. And then when he spoke to my sister and I, and when we were speaking privately at home, it would be a mixture of Japanese and English.
What about you and your sister? What did you speak to one another?
We spoke English to each
you
other.
You did.
Yeah, we spoke, and then as we got older, I mean, you know, we became much more fluent, and we were able to talk about things you know, we didn't speak to our parents much about, not only the language, but just generationally and you know, the kind of things that kids talk about and adults talk about, you know.
What about the interactions? Culture. What about the interactions with your father and his customers?
Well, my father knew dollars and cents real well. He was a good businessman, and he had beautiful handwriting, and he was a calligrapher as well. He did nice, you know, brush paintings of Japanese ideograms, kanji, and so in talking to customers, I mean, there's not much conversation going on. Somebody brings in clothes, and you know how to fill out a tag and a receipt and exchange money and all those things. And sometimes salesmen would come in, and then they'd try to strike up a conversation with my father, if the chemistry was right between them, well, then they would converse, and they would be able to converse in a way that you know, my father could understand more than he could speak. So, and then the people that he was speaking to, some people were more able to understand his manner of speaking than others. So, and then my father would get impatient too sometimes if the conversation weren't going the right way. He just cut the conversation off, but he was kind of an interesting character.
Well, tell me about your recollections of the war, because you talk about that here. Mm-hmm. Tell me what your recollections are about when the war began and what happened with your father's business.
Yeah, well, you know, before the war began, there was a war already going on between Japan and China. And for me growing up with all that happening, and because my father was so very, very sensitive, you know, to the persecution that discrimination that he experienced, and he often, you know, would fly off the handle if he heard someone utter the word Jap, and so I grew up with that, and when that war was going on, I'd go in the movie theater and I'd be sitting there with, you know, and watching the newsreels, waiting for the cartoons to come on because of these scenes of the war, and sometimes there'd be like the interview of a American mercenary pilot who was flying for the Flying Tigers, the British Royal Air Force against Japan, and it was very upsetting to hear, you know, the way they spoke about Japan and Japanese. So with that happening when the war began, I wasn't surprised that we were going to really be in for it, you know, because of all the hatred or discrimination that had already been going on previously.
And did you feel that at elementary school, or did you feel that yourself?
Well, I couldn't be thinking about it every day, but sometimes things would happen, or and those are there were things that I could recall that were very stressful or conflicting.
And where did you go to elementary school? What was the name of it?
Well, we went to elementary school when we had the cleaners on Polk Street, which is, you know, we were there until a year before the war began. Mm-hmm. I went to Spring Valley School, which is on Hyde, and it's on Jackson Street near Hyde. It's kind of near Chinatown. And we were living in the North Beach, which, you know, was mainly majority of Italian ancestry, mm-hmm. people of Italian ancestry. So it was pretty much a white community. And after that, and then we were going to Japanese school. School bus would pick us up after about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and we'd be in Japanese school for 2 or 3 hours, and then come home for dinner. And then a year before the war began, my father sold his cleaners to my cousins, his nephews, who had left the chicken ranch in Petaluma and wanted to live in the city. And so then when he sold the cleaners on Polk Street, he looked for another cleaners, and ended up Sunset District, where he found a vacant store and had it remodeled and into a dry cleaning store with the proper layout of work areas, and then we lived in back of that cleaners as well. So we were about a year, maybe not even a year, maybe 8 or 9 months in that cleaners when the war began. And it began on a Sunday, and I heard it on the radio, and that's my opening chapter where my sister and I are reading comics, and the news comes on the radio, and my father had been drinking the night before, and so he was not in a very good mood that morning, and I had the radio. I turned it up really high because it didn't seem like anyone was listening, and I could hear all this about the ships that were on fire and sunk, and it was just very shocking, but I knew then that we were going to be punished somehow. But I didn't. I thought it would be more, of more name calling than what really happened. But I was kind of afraid to go back to school. I didn't know how the children, the classmates, would feel about what had happened, and the teachers. I didn't know, I had no idea of what actions they would take or what they would say. So I think we were on Christmas break too at the time, so I don't think we went to school, the next day. Because I remember we were sitting there the next day listening to President Roosevelt's speech about the day in infamy, and then there was all this talk between my father and his brothers and friends and the FBI and people being taken away. Some of my father's friends, and they didn't know where to. The FBI came and just searched their houses and then took the husband or father off to somewhere without telling anybody where they were going to be taken to.
And it sounds like your family, your father, was insistent about getting rid of things that could be incriminating, like your mother's girl's day dolls.
Yeah, well, when all this was happening, we kept thinking. I wondered, but I was just a kid. If they would ever come after us, so my father was having conversations with a lot of friends in the Japanese community, and he belonged to Hiroshima Kenjinkai, the Japanese Hiroshima Prefectural Organization for the Japanese nationals in America, in San Francisco, and his newspaper friend, I can't remember his name now, but we had Nichibei Times. Was taken away, the Buddhist, Ishida Niten, the Buddhist church, I think he was taken by the FBI. And so everybody was fearful of, who's going to be next. Mm-hmm. And so then my father, I remember, the alarm was out, you better just get rid of anything that looks like, you have any connections to Japan. So both my father and mother just, you know, went through all the stuff that we had, dolls and swords and scrolls and whatever. And, you know, we'd celebrate Boys' Day and Girls' Day with dolls, all those dolls. And I can't remember exactly all the items, but there was a lot. We put it in the trunk of the car. And one night we took it out to the beach or to the dump near the beach and buried everything. And then several days after that, my mother recalled that there were these books in the closet that they'd forgotten about, and there were a lot of books and magazines and Japanese periodicals. And so there wasn't, it was just during the day, and there was no, and they were afraid the FBI would be at our place anytime soon, so they decided to flush it down the toilet, tearing pages out of books, and I remember the toilet getting clogged and overflowing with toilet water, and it was just a mess, and it was scary actually for me, because I had no idea where all this was going, you know. And then my uncle, Roksan, he was a photographer, and then he told my father about all the films that he burned. And so very soon after that, the FBI did come, two agents, and they were at our cleaners for 2 or 3 days. And I don't know of anybody else that had FBI stay at their place, you know. I mean, they didn't literally stay, but they kept coming back. And when I think back now, I think the reason may be because we had left. My father had sold the cleaners on Polk Street after all those years, and then moved to the Sunset, which was near the ocean, mm-hmm. which maybe, you know, they thought that my father might have had some signaling device or something, you know, to contact enemy submarines or something, you know. But they stuck around, and they also, I don't know if I mentioned in a book or not, but they took him into the bar and they got him drunk, and they, I guess they thought they could get some information out of him that way. So it wasn't soon after that that we decided that we better get out of the city, and we went to Stockton with my uncle and aunt.
Mm-hmm. To your grandparents' hotel.
To my grandparents' hotel. So, but, you know,
And what happened to the cleaners when you went to Stockton?
Well, my father tried to find, and then my uncle too, they both had cleaners, but they tried to sell the business to anyone they could, but mm-hmm. No, they couldn't find anyone to buy it. So they ended up not selling it, but giving it to someone who had worked for the wholesale cleaning plant where, you know, in a dry cleaning business, retail business, the clothes are cleaned in carbon tetrachloride or some sort mm-hmm. of cleaning chemical at a plant, and then returned to the cleaners, and then they're pressed and ironed. Mm-hmm. So someone from one of those plants, I guess, my father was able to give the business to that person, who then took it without paying for it, and then we just left.
And at that point, when you were leaving, were there families who were being taken to internment camps, or was there any of that movement yet?
No. The executive order that President Roosevelt signed, Executive Order 9066, which he signed on February 19th, 1942, the war was December 1941, was the order which empowered the military to, or authorized the military to start building these camps, 10 camps in remotely located areas in the hinterlands of America. Initial order, I mean, for us to go to camp, we didn't go directly to Rowarth, which is where we finally ended up, but we went to an assembly center in Stockton with the fairgrounds.
So you were not, you didn't go to Tamforan?
We didn't go to Tamforan. Okay. The people who lived in San Francisco went to Tamforan.
So you would have gone there had you
Had we remained in San Francisco, we would have gone to that. And my wife, Keo, she was she lived in San Francisco and with her family and her brothers and sisters, and they went to Tamforan and then to Topaz, Utah. So we went to Stockton. And from Stockton Assembly Center, we went to the Assembly Center in the San Joaquin fairgrounds in Stockton, where they made some makeshift barracks and built places where mess halls where we could eat. But we went from there to Rower in September.
So in what state? Where is Rower?
Rower's in Arkansas. And so
where did Keo go after Tamforan?
Keo went to Topaz, Utah.
And stayed
she was there, yeah, for, I guess, the duration mm-hmm. of the war. We left camp about a month or two before the war ended.
So they took you by train or by bus, or how did you go to Rower?
We were on the train, and the train... we went by bus to the assembly center. We had these Greyhound buses, I guess they were. And then from Stockton to Rower by train, and I think we went through Denver. It was about 4 days and three nights, and it wasn't a Pullman. We were in wooden seats. We stayed in Rower for 3 years, approximately 3 years before we left to go to Denver, Colorado. I think California was still not open to
internees. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you went to middle school then at Rower, right?
Rower I went from sixth grade through ninth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Denver, where we spent a year, I was in the 10th grade. I went to Manual Training High School there. And then when we returned to California, I went to Lowell High School in junior and senior year. And then I went in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Berkeley, at UC Berkeley. And I was in Berkeley I went through the ROTC program at Berkeley.
How was that for your family to go through, for their child who had just who had been interned with a family to then join the ROTC program.
My father said, you're never going to become an officer. They're not going to let you be an officer. He says, that's just a trick. You're going
to
be.
Why did you feel it that you wanted to do that?
The war was going on in Korea then, and I was having difficulty with my education. I had gone into pre-med. I had good grades in high school.
And what year did you graduate from Lowell High School?
I graduated in 48, spring of 48. And I was CSF, or what is it? I was on. I had very good grades.
The honor roll.
Honor roll, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I got into Berkeley easily. And then I didn't really bear down very hard when I went to Berkeley. And so I received some very poor grades. And then I was afraid I wouldn't graduate. So and ROTC was a way that I could complete my education. And my parents were so proud because I was the first Omi to go to university, go to college, university.
And what was Berkeley like at that time with, did you face discrimination at Cal, or what did you feel there?
Well, we had a Nisei Students Club, you know, mm-hmm. And we...
Which I think they still have.
we banded together. Norman Mineta was a friend of mine. Oh. You know, we went through, we're about the same age. Mm-hmm. I think he was in Topaz, mm-hmm. Utah.
Yes.
And so it was, there weren't any racial problems that, you know, mm-hmm. except that, you know, we just like to hang out with our own.
Did you live in a dorm, or did you live at home?
Yeah, I lived in a Japanese... I was in a Japanese... not a dorm, but a housing facility. Mm-hmm. A house that was rented by... renting and run by a Japanese family. And they were... I think it was like a 4 or 5 bedroom house, and about 8 or 9 of us, you know, we didn't all have rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Northgate area in Berkeley.
And what did you major in if you were pre-med originally?
I started pre-med, and then I switched to chemical engineering, mm-hmm. and then I ended up in soil science.
Graduating what year?
1954.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me a while. 48. Yeah. And then soon after I graduated, I received a commission, and the Korean War was still being waged, became a civil engineering, Corps of Engineering officer, construction engineering.
And what rank were you at that
point? I was a first lieutenant, and I served in Korea for 16 months. And then when I returned from Korea, my father had a bonsai business.
So he had left the dry cleaning.
He was doing both for a while, and then he began the bonsai business about the time that I was in the service, I guess, mm-hmm. in the army, and even before that. I'm sorry, he began the bonsai business in about 52. And he had my mother and father, and he had the cleaning business. they were doing quite well, but his passion was with driftwood and not bonsai at first, potted plants and goldfish.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually that became all consuming, and he had a pretty good collection of trees, enough to start a business, and mm-hmm. that was in 1952 or 53, I think.
So then you came back from the war.
And then when I came back from the war, I joined him.
What was the business called?
Bonsai by K. Mm-hmm. K. Kengo Omi.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, but we had disagreements philosophically mm-hmm. About how to run the business and how to treat customers, and so we didn't see eye to eye on everything. And so finally I decided that I would leave to go back to school, and I was interested in gardens, so through bonsai a lot of people had asked if I could design a garden for them, and so I thought, well, maybe I could learn something about that in school. So I went on GI Bill, I went back to Berkeley, and then I got a degree in landscape architecture. And then after that, after school, I was very fortunate to have been hired by Pete Walker, who now has a very large firm in Berkeley. I think he's probably a 100-man firm, but he designed the gardens for the Twin Towers, you know, after it was destroyed, the new structure mm-hmm. that replaced the Twin Towers. They have a large, a garden and memorial area, I joined him, his firm, when it was a 3-man firm in San Francisco, and he'd come out from Watertown, Massachusetts, Harvard, where Hideo Sasaki was the chairman of the Department of Landscape Architecture at Harvard, and he had large office, private practice, well connected to leading contemporary architects of that time. So he grew a large practice, and he was a professor and chairman of the department as well. So Pete Walker came out to the West Coast to do Foothills College. Ernest Kump was the architect, I remember, then, and a very good architect, and did a lot of award-winning work. And so Pete came out to do that college campus at Hillside Campus, and that's about the time that I joined him, and like a 3-man firm. I worked with him for 13 years. He made me a partner after about 3 years, and we grew it to about 72-man firm in Sausalito. We finally moved to Sausalito. It's SWA Group now, and it has offices all over the country. I was with him for 13 years and then left because my father and mother were having a problem with their marriage, and my father had left my mother. And so then I but I would they willed the bonsai business to me,
mm-hmm.
and I thought maybe that I could, you know, do something with it, but in the end I ended up having to give up that business and spend full time in landscape architecture.
Did your sister have any interest in bonsai or landscape
architecture? No, she didn't. She married a dentist, and they were. He was interested in bonsai, her husband, but
did she stay in San Francisco, or where?
No,
did
they live in Los Altos Hills.
Oh, okay.
And they were in Palo Alto and then Los Altos Hills.
And when did you and Keo meet?
We met when she was just starting to just finish high school, starting Berkeley, and I was I guess I was a sophomore or a junior then.
So you both are Cal. You met at Cal.
Yeah, we met at Cal. But she didn't finish Cal. She went I guess a couple of years, and then and then I went into the Army and all that.
And how many children do you have?
I have 4 children and 7 grandchildren.
Mm-hmm. What are your children's names?
My oldest, Sharon, was our first child, and she's an actor, and she lives in Southern California. She was interested in acting even while she was a high school student, and she won the drama award at Tam High School, and she went on to UC Santa Cruz and got her degree there in anthropology and theater arts. And
how old is she now?
She is about 60 now. And then I have a daughter, a second daughter after her, Laura. She lives in Santa Barbara, and Sharon has one child, one daughter, Rosie, who went to Pomona, and she's a writer and an actor too. They both are actors, and their husband, her father, Rosie's father, Sharon's husband, they're divorced. So Sharon and Rosie are together there, and they're doing a lot of commercials, and in fact they did a play together, stage play together, down in Southern California. I can't remember what it was called. It was based on a classic story book. Anyway.
And where's Laura? You said
Laura's in Santa Barbara, and she has 2 children. And then I have a son, Brian, who has 2 children, Garrett. You know, Kristen and Garrett. And then Jeff, our youngest, has 2 boys that are 2 years old and 4 years old now. So it's quite a spread in age.
And when did you and your family, when did you come to Mill Valley?
Well, we were in San Francisco when I first began work as a landscape architect in the city. And
what year was that?
That was about 1964. And then the office that I was working with Pete Walker, they kept growing, and we kept moving in the city. We moved 3 times. We were on in Jackson Square, and then we moved to Commercial Street, where that was kind of like down in the heart of the financial center. And then we moved to another office on Clay Street, and each time we moved, because we had more people than the space could handle that we were in, and finally we decided that well, maybe we better find something larger someplace, not in the city, because it was getting, you know, it was getting to be very expensive for the kind of space that we needed. And so we found in Sausalito the old cheese factory, which was near the Corps of Engineers building.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a large structure that then we had an architect, you know, design and lay it out for us in a way that we were able to. I think we moved in with 30 people then, 30 staff. And then the commuting from San Francisco to Marin, you know, became a chore. And we were looking for a house then. I guess we could have bought in the Sunset, but we decided that maybe it'd be better to be closer to where I was working. So we started looking around here, and we almost bought a house in Terra Linda, and we also in Larkspur, that was a place, and Mill Valley was so, you know, it's such a nice town center, and it had all the kind of stores and restaurants, and the people, you know, were so nice that we decided that, you know, that Mill Valley was where we wanted to live, and so we found this place.
In what year was that?
That was 19. I'm sorry, I got the years mixed up. It was mm-hmm. 1964 when we bought this house.
Okay.
So it had to be 1962, I think.
When your firm moved to Sausalito.
I think that's right. My mind is kind of fuzzy right now. but it was in the early 60s.
Mm-hmm. What was Mill Valley like then when you first moved here?
Well, it was, our kids were growing up, and what we found is that, the schools were good here, and that was one of the reasons we came over this way, because the schools were a lot better, you know, in Mill Valley and in Marin than they would be in San Francisco anywhere, that we could afford to stay. And even staying here was a little bit of a stretch, but then the people who were selling it had children and they were moving to a larger place, and they said they wanted to have a family move into the house. It would be nice to, you know, have a couple with children. You know, that's the way our family grew, and so, you know, they were very generous with us for the down payment and everything. And
did you face any discrimination in Mill Valley at all?
No, it was very friendly. Mm-hmm. And when we moved in, the neighbors next door, the Rosens, invited everyone over, the neighbors, for a party to welcome us to the neighborhood. And the schools with Strawberry, the kids went to Strawberry Point School, mm-hmm. you know, where Rita Abrams wrote that song.
The Mill Valley song.
and then I coached, my son, oldest son, Brian, Jeff's, Greg Garrett's father, was a good ball player. And Little League, he started Little League very young, and one day the coach took ill and they needed somebody to help with the team, and so I volunteered, and before I knew it I became very much involved in Little League, so so did Keel.
And one thing I have to ask you, so I've read lots of books about the internment camps, and many of them mentioned baseball teams mm-hmm. at the camps. Did mm-hmm. you participate in anything like that?
Yeah, I like to play baseball and basketball, mm-hmm. But it wasn't organized. But for the, because I was, they didn't have Little League in mm-hmm. camp. So the older kids that who were in high school then had leagues, and they played ball in camp, and they played basketball. I mean, we even had a gym in camp, mm-hmm. But basketball, baseball, and football, the older kids played, and I enjoyed, you know, going to watch them play, and then we had, I guess in school we had teams, you know, but it was more like pickup mm-hmm. play
than organized little league like your kids have.
Yeah. Yeah, in camp it was just remarkable, the programs that the ISEE,
the first generation,
developed to make camp more hospitable and more comfortable, you know, for everyone, but most importantly for the children. And
what do you recollect about? Do you talk to your grandchildren about what life was like during that time? Have you?
Yeah, Garrett knows a lot about that because Garrett grew up with that. You know, I was a writer. I began writing when I was about 62 years old, and this was towards the end of my career. I had about 10 years left, I guess. I retired when I was 72, but I didn't know that I could write at all. But I began writing my memoirs, and then I let my kids read the stories, and they'd say, "Hey, you got to keep writing," mm-hmm. you know. And so then eventually, well, Garrett was born in 94, I guess 93 or 94, or maybe later. But by the time he was, I guess, in junior high school, all these stories that I had written, I mean, it became like manuscripts. Mm-hmm. I had tons of writing. I can show you boxes of stuff that I
would love to see it.
But I just wrote and wrote, and I took classes, workshops. I went up to Squaw Valley 3 times, community writers workshop, and Jim Houston, who was Gene Wakatsuki's wife, they wrote Farewell to Manzanar, yes. which is one of the classics, mm-hmm. and we became fast friends. He's gone now, and then there was Al Young, who was also another acclaimed author and world traveler and professor and all, and he was a workshop leader up at Squaw Valley for me 1 year, and he was the one that read my manuscript and said, "Hey, you got something here. You got, you know." And if I were you, I'd put that bombing of Pearl Harbor episode first. That mm-hmm. should be your first chapter. And then he says, and then bring everything around that. Mm-hmm. You know.
I just found when I was growing up that There was barely any mention of any of this in textbooks. So my mother brought in the books by Yoshiko Uchida, Journey to Topaz,
yeah.
and Farewell to Manzanar. But it sounds like you spoke to your kids a lot about your experiences.
Yeah, I did, and my kids got a lot of it. And my grandchildren, two of them are writers,
mm-hmm.
Rosie, and who is Sharon, my oldest mm-hmm. child's daughter, and Garrett,
mm-hmm.
and they, because I was, as I wrote these pieces, often, like I wrote that Poochie, the Poochie the dog,
mm-hmm.
Story, and about just a lot of different aspects of what life was like before the war, and then during the war, and the things we lost and all. And they weren't written in the order they are in my book, mm-hmm. you know. But somehow I put it all together towards the end of when I stopped writing, toward, which was about 19... It was about 2002, I guess, because mm-hmm. I couldn't find a publisher or an agent that mm-hmm. wanted, you know. So then I had all these manuscripts that were floating around, you mm-hmm. know, and you know, I wasn't ashamed to share them with anybody that was willing to read them, mm-hmm. you know. And so I guess Garrett, he says that he's seen everything that I have in that book, but maybe not the way it was put together in mm-hmm. the book.
So how did you find the time to write when you were a landscape architect by day, writer by
It was night? I'm very compulsive, and I have, after work I'd come home, and thank God for the computer, because if it was handwritten, I would never have gotten anywhere I am now, because I constantly change things. I'm never satisfied with the way I put it down the first time, mm-hmm. you know. And so even the manuscript, I've got maybe 3 or 4 different versions of the same story, and maybe ordered differently, and then maybe there might be more scenes or more episodes in one than the other. And I was really struggling to try to put this thing together in a way that, you know, someone could pick it up and just keep reading without, you know, stopping.
Oh, I think you definitely achieved that in this book. It's wonderful. Did you ever have you shared this with the people in your field that you know, like that? Because it sounds like your writing life and your career life were separate. But did you talk to your colleagues about any of this?
Well, just recently I did. Mm-hmm. We had a reunion. I have years ago, when I was with Pete Walker, and we had our office in Sausalito, as a young fella from Japan, he worked for Kashigojima Construction Company, and they sent him to school to learn landscape architecture, and then he came to America to further his education. Mm-hmm. And ended up at Harvard, but before going, he stopped by our office in Sausalito, and spent a summer with me. We had like a work study program for students, and I kind of brought him in, and his name is Toru Miyakoda, and now he has an office in Tokyo and Singapore, and he's won awards all over the place. And so he came over. When we go to Japan, I visit with him. He takes me all over mm-hmm. just to look at his projects. And he comes out here for International Landscape Architects Conventions, and he's well known among landscape architects, younger than me, landscape architects, but some older ones too. Mm-hmm. And we had a dinner. And I said, hey, you guys, I wrote a book. They couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. And I passed it. I gave everybody a copy. Mm-hmm. And they were just, you know, they couldn't believe that I wrote that book. But writing is like designing. And, you know, in design, what I learned is that you have to have a visual image of what it is you're designing. You have to be able to see the whole thing, and you know, you have to have an idea, and then you build on that idea and you put the pieces together. And so when you're sketching, you know, a plan or cross sections, or as a designer, you have to be able to show your client what your idea is for whatever project they have, and not details, mm-hmm. you know, but just an overall concept. whether it's going to be hard or soft or bold or, you know, and so you're searching for ideas and it's sketching and sometimes it all comes out and you have it. And that's, writing is the same way. And I was working at all these pieces and the big idea for this book is the war and the internment. And so then that enabled me to put it all together in a way that there was a kind of a timeline and then the characters, you know, they're so important for me to be able to capture in a way that the reader would be able to visualize, to see.
And you absolutely can. There are quite a few stories that I've heard from internees who just did not want to talk about it anymore. Mm. Have you met people?
It's interesting because the people who have been in camp, that are my age, they read my book and they say, wow, I like this because it's not recriminating. It's not, you know, there's no bitterness, you know, and it's, you're telling it the way it was, at least the way they remembered it. You know, the people have people who were involved or who had been in camp have different perspectives or different thoughts about the happening and the internment.
Did you ever go into the elementary schools or to talk about your experiences?
Yeah, I had an event at Oakland Tech High School.
But to your own children's.
And to cemetery.
When your kids were in elementary school, did you talk about
it? No, because I didn't start writing until I was 62. And I had no idea that I would ever come up with, you know, a book about the internment or a story about the internment. I mean, I was so discouraged. After about 10 years, 12 years of working on it, that I couldn't find anybody interested I couldn't find an agent or publisher, and I sent query letters, synopses, and there were a couple of publishers and agents that appeared to have some interest in what I had, but no one was willing to take it on, and so that's why I just, you know, decided that I would give it up, and my wife. Let me see.
Oh yeah, let me pause this for a moment. So tell me a little bit. We'll do a few more. You know, about maybe 15 more minutes.
Sure.
Tell me about when you started your own company.
Well, I started my own company because my father and mother were having some difficulty with their marriage, and my second book is all about that, as a matter of fact. But it's rather scandalous, and so I have to be sure that I'm not offending anybody, because some of the members, older members of my family, are still alive. So, but there are people who say that don't worry about that, just go ahead and, you know, do your thing and it'll work out. But I don't feel that way about it at all, you know, because I don't really want to offend anybody or feel that I, you know, misrepresented. People see things differently, so anyway, that's my second book. And I left the firm because I wanted to help my mother, who my father had pretty much abandoned her, and she was so dependent on him for so many things, and so I helped her make the adjustments. And when I left the company that I was working with the understanding that I would not in any way attempt to pick up the clients that mm-hmm. I had, that I would start from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody thought I was crazy to do that, you know, because this was 1974.
Mm-hmm.
And this was when Jeff was born, my oldest son, about that time. And the country was in a depression, slight depression. The business wasn't good. There were offices that were folding. And here I was, you know. And I was one of seven partners, you know, and I was making good wages, and office was thinking to expand to other area venues, you know, and so I was leaving it behind, So the odds were against me, but I went, and Willie Lang, who was my friend from undergraduate school at Berkeley in landscape architecture, asked if he could join me,
mm-hmm.
and we left together.
And so you opened Omi and Lang?
Omi Lang.
And what year was that? That was 1974.
That was 1974, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the firm we left gave us a job in San Diego, downtown redevelopment, 14 square block, to set up the design guidelines for development. And so
we your development successful. Was San Diego, Yerba Buena, the Assimilar Center, San Ramon headquarters for Chevron, Levi Plaza.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever design anything in Mill Valley?
Tried.
Yeah. The projects were too small.
No, they weren't too small. Yeah. It was just that there, you know, there's Royston, Hanamoto, and Mays, you know. And Asa was a good friend of mine,
mm-hmm.
Asa Hanamoto, and Bob Royston, too. They're both gone now. There are a lot of good firms. And Eldon Beck, I mean, he was also part of that company. And Bob Royston and I went head to head on a project in Fairfax, I think it was, and he was such a charmer that mm-hmm. he was able to win that one hands down. There are a lot of good designers and architects and landscape architects in Marin County and Mill Valley and Sausalito.
And you've seen a lot of changes from the time you bought here till now. Yeah. What do you see as the major changes that you would describe to someone?
Well, where we're living now, there's when we bought this house, there was nothing beyond the end of the street, and now there's a whole slew of apartments and new development condos, and so now we get a lot of traffic on our street, which we never had before. So mm-hmm. when our kids were growing up, our older kids were growing up, we used to celebrate Halloween and have treats, you know, for all the kids that would come to the door. Now we don't get one. It's too dangerous to
walk
the street.
To walk along Strawberry
because,
Drive.
because it's become like an expressway.
So did all of your children go to Tam High?
They went to Strawberry Point School, and then they went to middle school. Sharon went to Edna McGuire.
Oh, when it was the middle
when it was,
school.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then Laura, our second daughter, went to middle school, and so did all the other kids, Brian and Jeff. Brian played baseball for Tam High. In fact, his pitching friend, Brian Price, was a manager for the Cincinnati Cincinnati Reds,
Reds.
I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sharon was very involved in acting,
mm-hmm.
and some of her friends went I can't remember that acting school now. Juilliard, I
mm-hmm.
guess, yeah. Laura was an artist. That's what she started. She studied at UC Santa Barbara, and she's done a lot of creative things,
mm-hmm.
paintings and sculpture. And Jeff, you know, our youngest, went to University of Oregon, and he's working as a web designer. As a web designer for Bank of America now.
Mm-hmm. Do any of your children speak Japanese?
Garrett.
Your grandson.
My grandson.
So skipped a generation.
And Brian might a little bit, but Garrett now is, I mean, he's been to Japan twice in the last couple of months, and he says he wants to live there, I think he's going to to apply for the JET program.
Mm-hmm. To teach English in Japan.
Teach English in Japan. Mm-hmm.
When you go back to Japan, do you visit Hiroshima or Osaka, or where do you...
Well, we go... 1 year, I took the whole family, grandchildren, there were, I think, 15 of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew the same aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that everybody didn't want to do the same thing. So I set up an itinerary, you know, sort of a core itinerary from which people could do different things,
mm-hmm.
you know. But we flew into Tokyo, and I got relatives in Yokohama, so
mm-hmm.
We visited with them for a while, and then we went to Okayama,
mm-hmm.
and then Okayama became a hub from where we could go to Kyoto and Osaka.
And where is Kyo's family originally from?
I'm sorry?
Your wife's family, where?
She's from Gunma.
Gunma-ken. Okay, Gunma Prefecture.
Mm-hmm. Prefecture, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And her father's cousin was the president of Olympus Camera.
Oh.
And he's a soft focus camera photographer, and he's had exhibits at the Illinois Institute, Chicago Institute in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And he's no longer living, but he used to make trips for doing his shows
mm-hmm.
of his photography.
So when your children were growing up, did you teach them a lot about Japanese culture then? Or did they go to any type of Japanese cultural events?
Well, we used to go... I took them to Japan
mm-hmm.
To visit with our family to visit... different parts of Japan, and I think we made 3 trips as family when the kids were in high school.
Mm-hmm.
But I never could find the time to I couldn't teach them Japanese because I didn't the language because you know my language is not educated.
Mm-hmm.
But they all had an interest in Japanese culture and Japanese language. They're not totally illiterate with the language, but they did spend time on their own to try to learn you know, simple phrases.
Mm-hmm.
Traveling to Japan and Rosie, also granddaughter, she spent a week or 2 weeks in an exchange program, you know, where she went to a family.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a great deal, there has been a great deal of interest by my children in Japan. But I think Garrett is the only one that's really committed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's because maybe his mother's family is a lot like my family. She is a Nisei.
So second generation.
Second generation. Mm-hmm. And her brothers and sisters went to camp. Her older brothers, she was too young for camp, mm-hmm. but her older brothers and sisters went to camp. In fact, they repatriated to Japan on the Grisholm. There was one ship that went from Tule Lake to Japan, mm-hmm. and they were, so they spent, during the war, they were in Japan as, they have a lot of stories to tell.
I'm sure. Yeah. Well, we are almost at an hour and a half of talking. Do you have any last thoughts, either about your childhood or your career or Mill Valley or anything?
Well, I think my last thought would be that the most important thing in my life has been my family.
Mm-hmm.
And that my family, whether it be my father and mother, my children, my wife, my grandparents. That's what's given me the strength and resolve to do what it is that I do. And I think that that's a key to success and stability of mind, and understanding people that you meet every day. Having a family that you love and loves you is important to well-being.
So. George, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah,
Mill Valley Public Library appreciates it so much. So I'm going to turn this off now.
Okay.
Thank you very, very much.